Yes, it's quite possibly the most welcoming place on the internet, the Parish of the Patriots. Welcome one and all. Episode 231, the Parish of the Patriots. Glad you joined us this week, whether you're a regular returning member of the congregation or someone new dropping in for the first time. Whatever brought you here, glad you're here. Glad you could join us. If you are new, we do have a Christian-specific segment that's very roughly around the halfway mark of the show. Very roughly. Sometimes earlier, sometimes later. Might want to stick around for it, but you've been warned one way or the other. We survive. I survive by passing the offering plate around. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. If you get something out of the show, you know, there's nothing behind a paywall. You get the show for free. So I mean, you can tune in every week and it doesn't cost you a dime. There's nothing extra. I don't have anything you can go to. And for a little extra, you get the good content. I put out, believe it or not, this is the good content. I know it's hard to believe, but it is. And so there's nothing, you know, nothing behind a paywall, nothing you got to pay for. But if you do get something out of it, drop something in the plate for goodness sakes. I want to hear a clink in there. Don't just thump the bottom of the offering plate. Put something in there. And as such, we hit the listener supporter mailbag. See, we're rolling along. We don't spend a lot of time. We don't waste a lot of time. Tony, appreciate it, Tony. Just dropping no note in there, but wanted to let you know I did get it. And as always, it's very much appreciated. GPD, here's some dough for the show, Mr. T. Every week. Thank you very much, Mr. T. Very much. Very much appreciated, as always. And finally, dear GPD, I'm not dead. Just way behind. Well, that's good to know. It's good to know that you're not dead. Neither am I. Some days I wake up, though, and I wonder, am I still alive? I blink and another four shows have been posted. Well, I remember today until the next time I look at the calendar and realize how much time has passed. Regards, Jackie. Thank you very much, Jackie. I do appreciate it. I'm glad you're not dead. I'm glad I'm not dead. Mostly, I'm glad I'm not. Some days it's like, yeah. But anyway, that gets us through our listener supported mailbag. We're less than 3 minutes in here. See, we've already gone through the passing the plate around, going through the listener supporter mailbag. So, see, it doesn't take very long. See, I have a little time. I do like the televangelists and spend the entire show, spend an hour harping about send money. But I don't do that. See, I don't put y'all through that. I read the other day a little kerfuffle, as I read a little kerfuffle between. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. Between the New York Times. Is anybody? There's something of pretension. Like if I ran into somebody and you just could say one thing about yourself, you know, imagine like if you meet somebody and there's like this requirement, you can say one thing about yourself and the other person has to judge you by what you say about yourself. You're allowed one statement. You meet somebody, you're allowed one statement about yourself. And what would that one statement be? And what would be the statement of the other person? And how would you judge that? You know, like for me, I would probably say something along the lines of, I've loved the Lord God with all my heart and all my mind and Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. And some of y'all that don't believe in all that be like, ooh, cringe, I'm going to run away. But that's, you could only make one statement. If I ran into somebody, met somebody, and they said about their statement about that stuff, I read the New York Times and drive a Tesla. I read the New York Times. I would already imagine, I would already have my impression of who that person was. Because who the hell, what kind of person still reads the New York Times? Like, you know, like unironically reading the New York Times. New York Times and Elon Musk had a little spat recently, which is whatever. But the topic was interesting because, you know, once again, in South Africa, this politician, whatever, was doing his whole routine. Or they sing this song about slaughtering white people. Kill the Boer, you know. Kill the Boer, kill the Boer. It's all about, the whole entire song is about slaughtering white people. And, of course, this is in the context of white farmers have been systematically brutalized. Of course, Western media ignores that. They've been murdered and brutalized in some of the most horrific ways imaginable. You could do it if you, for some reason, you're living under a rock and you read the New York Times. You can do just a minimum amount of research and find these stories about these brutal murders of the white farmers in South Africa, which is obviously approved by the government. And you have this politician. Now, of course, we live in clown world society here in the West, where anything where you disagree with the narratives of the left is hate speech. You know, any aspect of it, any criticism of it, they say that's hate speech. It's racism. It's hate speech. It's anti-Semitic. It's whatever. And they say your criticisms and your questioning of these things and you disagreeing with them is in and of itself violence. We've seen this time and time again where these people will say your words, your disagreement. And I'm not talking about people go like being edgy, you know, and saying edgy stuff, you know. I'm talking about just simply disagreeing. And they will say that your words amount to violence. In fact, what's one of their chants, one of their saying? Silence is violence. That's one of the things they chant, and they say silence is violence. In other words, it isn't enough if you just simply don't say anything. You see, you not only are you committing violence by disagreeing with the narratives, but you're committing violence if you don't say anything. Your silence is violence as well. Now, you have these pretentious people at the New York Times who go along with this, and they're part of that crowd. You know they are. And yet now you have this politician in South Africa where they make a whole theme about chanting this song about slaughtering white people. And this actually happens in South Africa. And the New York Times went out on a limb to say, oh, no, 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 no. You know, I think Elon Musk said something along the lines of, yeah, this happens. You know, white farmers are being systematically slaughtered, have been brutally slaughtered in South Africa. As a matter of fact, you know, they can't say without evidence because there's plenty of evidence. These farm murders, which are racially motivated in South Africa. And the New York Times went out on a limb and said, no, 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 no. You see, the song is a metaphor. It's a metaphor about the struggle. It isn't about promoting slaughtering white people. You know, I do. I get so tired and fatigued with the word magic, the stupid, obvious rhetoric that the anti-whites do. I do. I get tired of it because it's so stupid. Oh, what's that? You disagree with what I said and have proven my point is absolutely invalid with your facts? That's violence. How dare you? You've got to be permanently banned. What's this? People are being slaughtered because they're white in South Africa and the government there chants, kill them, kill them. No, no, that's not violence. That's not in sort of incitement to violence. That's not even hate speech. You see, it's a metaphor for the struggle. You know, and you can see, I was thinking about how this is also reflected in the regression, the deterioration of society here. Overall, in the U.S., we've got this situation now in the cities where, by and large, black people aren't arrested for committing crimes. You've seen the video. I mean, this, you've seen the video. The New York Times can say all they want to about, they said Elon Musk is promoting white supremacist conspiracy theories that white people are being murdered in South Africa. Even though there's all of these stories that you could go and just easily find. It's a white supremacist conspiracy theory. Their rhetoric is so poor that it's obvious they're just simply pushing an anti-white agenda. So what does that mean? Well, we look here in the U.S. and you've got all these videos. Black people go into a store and loot the store. And nobody stops them. They get assault people. Nobody stops them. If you're white or an Asian person, you get attacked by blacks on the street. I'm just telling it like it is. And of course, the pretentious assholes at the New York Times would sit there and say, that's a racist, you're white supremacist. We're just talking facts. There's no shortage. They can't say without evidence because there's no shortage of video evidence of white people and Asian people being attacked by blacks. The cops don't even bother. They don't. They might make some sort of, like, you know, token effort, like, you know, But they don't. We saw that incident in New York City where the black guy was freaking out on the subway. And they said, well, he had mental issues. And he may have. I mean, that's not the point. The point is when this white guy restrained him and in the struggle wound up killing him, which would not, you know, I mean, it wasn't the guy's intention. He wasn't trying to murder the guy. You know, oh, they come down on him. They come down on him with a hammer. And I was thinking of all of these things we're seeing taking place in the cities. You see, because in South Africa, a lot of this violence is, well, it's in the cities, but also it's directed at the white farmers. They go on these farms and they'll brutally, brutally slaughter these people, these white people in these rural areas. But you see, it's mostly in the cities here in the U.S. They're not systematically going about brutally murdering white people yet. But I mean, look at the direction things are going and you tell me where you think they're headed. You come to your own conclusion where you think they're headed. Are things getting better or are they getting worse? We're already getting in this pattern where the laws are not really are being enforced less and less in the name of equity against black people. And yet white people, if they fight back or defend themselves, the hammer is going to come down on them. And that is being reinforced by the media. They're reinforced. They want to make sure you get the message. You have to be victimized. You have to be victimized or else. And white people haven't got the message yet. You know, they don't. The white people haven't got the message. By and large, white people haven't got the message yet. They still think we have a functioning legal system. The average white person still thinks that. I'm amazed. You'll see a story. You know, you look at different stories. Let me take a look. And this didn't really directly involve black people, but just as an example of how white people haven't figured this out. The young man that wound up shooting people defending himself at the BLM riots up north. Dang it, his name. We talked about him so much, and see, I'm getting old. His name slips my mind. Do you know what I'm talking about? What did he do? He got into this situation and wound up shooting people defending himself, defending his life. And what does he do? He immediately goes and turns himself into the police. Now, he did wind up, you know, being exonerated on the charges. But he went through, you know, this horrible, horrible, long legal process. Well, that's an example of they didn't get the message. There was a riot going on, for goodness sakes. If he had a bandana on his face and after defending himself, he just fled the scene and all the chaos. You remember he's walking out there with his hands up hollering at the police and they just drove by him. And I'm thinking, dumbass, that was your cue to keep on going. Ain't got the message. White people ain't got the message. They still think, well, I did self-defense. Well, in some areas that may carry water. But that's not the direction that we're going. If you live somewhere like New York City or San Francisco and you've got to use force to defend yourself, you better just, I'm just going to tell you right now, if there's those cameras around, you better take a cue from the black people and haul ass out of there because the police aren't your friends. I'm just saying, you may be 100% justified. You may think, well, that doesn't, you know, if they find me later, then that's going to make me look guilty. Look, they're going to make you look guilty regardless. Prosecutor's job is not to get to the truth. It's to get convictions, okay? Just get out of there. Because then you got a chance that, you know, they ain't going to bother tracking you down. Just get out of there. You know, you can legitimately say you fear for your life. You don't know who else is around. I'm not saying go out there and get in trouble. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you were forced into a situation where you've got to defend yourself, I want to be clear on what I'm saying here. I'm not saying go intentionally. You know, one of my criticisms for what that young man got into is he shouldn't have been there in the first place. That was a bad decision. You can chalk that up to being young. It was a bad decision. Yes, technically, we're supposed to have freedom in this country, but you got to have some common sense. And he shouldn't have been there in the first place. But young people make foolish mistakes. But if you don't accept reality, you're going to get into a worse situation. you know, yes, we have freedom in this country. You should be able to wear what you want to. But if you go into a biker bar and you go patched up like you pretending you belong in a motorcycle club when you don't, and there's actual 1% MC members in there, you're going to get your ass kicked. You can sit there and talk about the Constitution and I got the right to all you want to, but you're still going to get your ass kicked. You got to have some common sense. Try to stay out of those areas, what I'm saying. I'm not telling you, I'm telling you specifically, don't go looking for trouble. What I'm talking about here is if you're minding your own business, going about your business, and you have to defend yourself because you're attacked, I don't think, you know, go call 911 and turn yourself into the police is a real smart idea. I'm thinking you just pack your shit up and go. They run you down later, then fine. I mean, a legitimate thing is you don't know who else is around. You don't want to have to defend yourself further. You know, it's a good idea to de-escalate the situation by leaving as soon as you possibly can, because other people might show up and then you're going to have to defend yourself more. And that's going to make things look worse. The point here is I'm getting bogged down in something I didn't mean to be. The point is you can see the South African system being implemented in the cities in the U.S. today. And these things are a step-by-step basis. You could be allowed to defend yourself. When these white farmers get brutally slaughtered in South Africa, there isn't an investigation. They make a token statement and say they're looking for somebody or whatever, but there's not a real investigation. We aren't at that point yet, obviously, but we're not. That's the direction. I think a reasonable person could look at the trends here and say this is what we're trending to. And I think there's reinforced when pretentious assholes like the New York Times sit there and say, oh, well, that doesn't mean there's violence going on in South Africa. You could easily say the New York Times says without evidence that there's not violence against white farmers in South Africa. You see, these are just metaphors. It's just metaphors. It's not calling for killing people, even though the song specifically says go out and murder people. People in jail for making joke songs about Hitler on the internet. There's guys in prison for making joke songs about the Holocaust. Because that's violence. It's inciting violence somehow. No, it's just a silly joke song. And yet you have people in power in a place like South Africa literally chanting a song saying, kill these people, murder these white people. And the New York Times says that's a metaphor. You just don't understand it's a metaphor for the struggle against white supremacy. Look, I don't care about their word magic. Their intentions are clear. This is the anti-white narrative. And it's very ugly. It's very ugly. You know, I'm as skeptical as anybody about the long-term sustainability of any multicultural society. I am. And people get hung up. They say, well, you know, like you're going to have this 100% racial society. And that's not the way that you're always going to have other people living amongst you. Problem is when the percentages hit a certain level, then you start becoming an actual multicultural society. And I'm as skeptical as anybody about the long-term sustainability of what you would call an actual multicultural society. That having been said, it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, if I were in charge, like you handed me multicultural America today and you said, Dan, you're the king of America now. We got rid of the democracy system. You are now the king of America. And, you know, the one caveat to that is you've got to maintain it like it is. You know, the demographics are like they are. You can't change that. But other than that, you're the king. You rule America. What are you going to do? You got to maintain this multicultural America, but you've got ruling authority. You know, I wouldn't be doing this. The first thing you would do, the first thing I would do is not stoke racial hatred against any group, one way or the other. This rings true. This shines the light on their lies about multiculturalism, that they support multiculturalism. This shines the light on their lies about equity, multiculturalism, and everybody getting along. Because what they do is they agitate for the opposite. If I were running King Dan, running a multicultural America, the first thing I would do is clamp down. And this is, by the way, what so-called quote-unquote dictators have done in multicultural societies elsewhere in the world. The first thing you've got to do is clamp down on this animosity one way or the other towards any racial group. I would clamp down and say, okay, we're not going to have people stirring up hatred towards any racial. We got to calm that down. You notice, though, they do the opposite. They stoke racial hatred, especially with the black community, towards white people. This is constantly stoked by the media, while at the same time demonizing white people anytime they speak up for themselves and say, well, I really would like to go to the shopping mall without worrying about being caught up in a shooting. The next thing you would have to do is, enforce the law equally, not this leftist shitlib gibberish about equity, equally under the law. You got to put people in jail. You got to enforce the law equally. You got to clamp down on this crime. If white people can't go to town with their kids without worrying about being accosted by black people and, being in danger of violence, that is going to stoke racial animosity. So you got to clamp down on that crap. And it helps everybody. I always point out black crime affects black people. These white shitlibs that live in a nice, protected, gated community, they love to go out and talk about eliminate the police in the black community because they don't have to live there in a damn war zone. Black people have to live in a damn war zone. Well, tough, they're on their own. They always act like putting criminals in jail somehow is punishing black people. So they allow this lawlessness, and it's black people that have to live amongst all this lawlessness. Why people don't want their kids going out and worrying about their kids going outside to play and getting shot? They don't want that. Yet these pretentious assholes, like those who work at the New York Times, this is why journalists are the scum of the earth, by the way, they will sit there and advocate things that are bad for everything. Bad for everybody. The first thing you would do is do everything you can to minimize racial animosity. There's always going to be a certain level of racial animosity in a multicultural society because that's just how people are. People are going to be with their group and they're going to have a certain amount. The other people, they're going to view them as quote unquote the other. So if I was a king of this multicultural society, first thing I would do is make sure and tamp all that down. You want to minimize, you want to throw water on any spark of racial animosity that you can as quickly as you can so that it don't spark something that can get out of control. But that's not what we have. These same people that say, oh, multiculturalism, diversity is our strength. They're the ones, as soon as they see anything that they can use as a spark, they run out there and pour gas on the fire. At least if that spark is black people primarily against white people, they throw gas on the fire. If it's the other way around, they throw water on it and tell you, oh, you're just an evil racist hater. Not everybody is like that in this other racial group. When people don't see the laws being enforced equally, when white people look, it doesn't matter what pretentious assholes at the New York Times say, when white people as a whole look and they see black people are able to just walk into the store, fill a basket and run back out, nobody's going to do anything. This stokes up racial animosity in the white community. They claim people, making jokes or pointing these things out are racist, and they're the ones who are somehow causing violence. But it is they, it's their policies. This stokes up racial animosity. You've got to enforce the law equally. People want to believe that the laws are going to be enforced fairly and equally. Of course, this won't happen in America because if you're enforcing the laws equally, that means rich people get to go to prison for their crimes. It doesn't mean that the guy who robs the liquor store and steals 5 cartons of cigarettes and a 12-pack of beer, that guy's got to go to prison. But it also means that the guy who embezzles $12 million from the company, he's got to go to prison too. It means the guy that paid off politicians and got laws written so that his corporation could get a special break, both him and the politician should go to prison too. Of course, we're talking about a monarchy. You wouldn't have to worry about that. That's one of the great inherent things about the democracy system is those things don't go punished. If you're going to enforce the law equally, people need to look and they say, well, rich people are going to prison too. So we know we have confidence, we have faith in the system because The laws are also enforced equally on the wealthy. They're enforced equally on white people. They're enforced equally on black people. Whatever group it is, regardless, if you do more crime, everybody knows you're going to go to prison at a higher number. So don't do the crime. It's that plain and that simple. That's what you would do. If you're going to run a multicultural society, at the bare minimum, these are the things you got to do. You got to try to minimize tension, and that's not what they do. They say they believe in diversity and multiculturalism, but they don't, because they are the ones who are constantly stoking up racial animosity. As you know, they mean to stoke it up against white people, but in so doing, they themselves stoke up that animosity among white people against the others. And it doesn't have to be this way. It really doesn't. Again, I'm as skeptical as anybody about the long-term sustainability of multicultural societies, but it does not have to be like it is right now. This is ridiculous. What we have got right now, this is absolutely absurd. It is. It's absolutely ridiculous. And nobody, and when I say nobody, I mean run-of-the-mill people here, regular people living in this hellhole of a country of whatever race. Nobody, regular people, is benefiting from this. You know, nobody's benefiting from this. Black people as a whole are not benefiting when other black people can go into stores and just loot the store and run out the door. They're not. They're not benefiting as a people for that. Nobody's benefiting from this. And yet this is what we see. This is what we see from these anti-whites. And that's what it comes down to, is anti-white. Their anti-white agenda. If it hurts white people, they don't care if it hurts anybody else. If it hurts white people, they're for it. That plain, that simple. There's the bottom line. They can use all the magic words they want and their stupid rhetoric. Look, it's time to just call it for what it is. They are the biggest promoters. People like these journalists at the New York Times, they are the biggest promoters of hate among anybody. And it's intentional. They intentionally promote more hate than anybody. We got to see them for what they are and call them out for what they are. Look, we need to go ahead and get into the Christian specific segment. I'm going to go ahead. It just, you know, look, it's just one of those things, you know, it galls you to see these people who, you know, the other day probably were running around saying that you daring to disagree with the narrative is somehow equates to hatred and is going to cause the slaughter of people and violence, even though they can't prove that. But they, in their minds, disagreeing with them equals violence. And you know, then the same people turn around and say, openly chanting, people in power openly chanting and celebrating the murder of white people. That's okay. That's somehow not hate speech. It's ridiculous. Anyway, I just couldn't let it go. Had to talk about it. Hope you enjoyed that part, because we're moving right along. We're going to go into the Christian specific segment. So you know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon here at the Parish of the Patriots. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 31 says, "And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart." Welcome to this week's Christian-specific segment, the sermon, if you would, here, the Parish of the Patriots, if you're new around here. I'm glad you decided to stay tuned in. If you're a regular member of the congregation, I'm doing something a little bit different this week, I think. I'm trying something a little different just because I like to switch things up. Normally, we stick on one subject matter in this segment. Today, we're going to probably hit a lot of different things. It's going to be more kind of like the first part of the show where it's more kind of rambling, but of course, obviously, Christian specific in its nature. This isn't really a specific change to the way we do things. It's just the way I'm doing it this week, just because I feel like it. Now, we just read that. We just read Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 31. And the reason I read that is I wanted to share something with you. I'm carousing through the interwebs the other day, and I come across a comment where some rando on the internet quoted this verse of the Bible. And they went on from that verse of the Bible to say, this proves that the concept of hellfire does not exist with the Lord, and he would never use something akin to fire to punish sinful people. There's not a lot. I can feel all of y'all, regular members of the congregation, face-palming just as hard as I did when I saw that. You know, back in the day, they had this idea, you know, you always hear that back in the day, the people weren't allowed to have their own copies of the Bible and how this was a bad thing. But when I read this and I hear some people's takes on biblical things, I think that was not necessarily wrong. I was sitting there, but my first reaction when I saw this was to think, you know, the peasants shouldn't have ever been given copies of Bibles because of this sort of thing. Of course, it's more insidious than that. It gets worse than that, because I'm sure this rando on the internet didn't come up with this on his own. He probably went to an MCC somewhere, and his MCC preacher stood there and spouted this off as a way to say that basically hell doesn't exist. No, hell doesn't exist. God gives you a timeout or some other nonsense. You know, I find it funny when people go to these churches that preach that hell doesn't exist and God would never send anyone to hell because, you know, love, blah, blah, blah. I have to wonder if it never crosses people's minds to think, you know, if people work so hard to convince themselves and others that hell doesn't exist, how do they have any confidence in their salvation in Christ? You know, I mean, yes, hell exists, and it's a very, the concept of it is very terrifying. But, you know, we're supposed to have the confidence of our salvation in Jesus Christ. I mean, to understand, you know, hell shouldn't be something that fills you with terror and you sit around shivering because you know that you're not going there. But it is, it does serve as a warning, and honestly, it serves as a reminder of God's justice. I've said this before, you know, these people that just go on about love, God's love, they don't even understand what God's love is. How can you say God's love and God's pure love for his people? How could you say that was real if he would bring those people, if he would bring those who've served him and have been persecuted for the sake of his name into his kingdom, and then turned around and brought those who persecuted them, brought those who lied about them, brought those who murdered them, brought those who rejected and mocked the name of the Lord. He just brought them into heaven too and said, okay, y'all get along. That wouldn't be very loving to his people now, would it? Because it wouldn't be just. Hell itself is a reminder of God's love, because God's love also is interconnected with God's justice. He wouldn't love his children if he let their tormentors come right in and get the same reward that they did. If I was sitting at a church and the preacher made it a point to preach sermons about how somehow hell doesn't exist, I would sit there and wonder why that person felt the need to do that. I mean, are they trying to keep a foot on both sides of the line? There's an old Johnny Cash quote attributed to Johnny Cash that says, there is no fence sitting between heaven and hell. There is no straddling that line. It's an either or. It's a black or white. There is no shade of gray. You're going one way or the other. Now, if I was, like I say, if I was sitting in church and preacher made it a point to always tell people hell isn't real and hell doesn't exist, I'd say, well, why would he need to say that? Why did he feel the need to do that? Why is he holding on? What's he holding on to that he doesn't want to let go of? You know, you think about the story of Lot's wife talking about not wanting to let go of. You know the story of Lot's wife, speaking of hellfire. Yeah, that was the other thing about this whole thing. You know, oh, the concept of hellfire, is it real? Like, did you miss the entire story of Sodom and Gomorrah? You know, Sodom and Gomorrah didn't get washed away in the flood. They got destroyed by hellfire. And yet somebody's saying, oh, God would never use fire. Look, I say this. Look, if you have questions, you know, about these things that you just don't understand, please ask. Straight up. Please ask. Don't be in ignorance and don't be afraid. You know, drop me an email. If there's something and you're like, you've been wondering about and you're like, I don't want to ask because I don't want to send, I don't want to put anything in the plate and put my question with it. Look, just drop, you know, and maybe this question will sound stupid or something. Look, just drop me an email. I'll at least answer it in the email. You know, I because I don't want you to go around being ignorant. I'll do the best I can. I can't look. I'm not promising that I have all the answers or that I have perfect answers. But don't go around in ignorance to where you're spouting stuff like this, looking stupid on the internet for everybody to see, saying that somehow God condemning the people because they were passing their sons and daughters through the fire, which I would remind you that entailed throwing their infants to be burned alive. It wasn't like there was a fire there and they jumped over it. No, they threw them in there, and while the infants were screaming, burning alive, they would have an orgy and have sex in the temple while the screams are going on in the background. This was a very hideous, demonic practice. You know, where you think that somehow means God would never use fire to destroy the earth or destroy or punish sinful people when the Bible is full of warnings about that very thing. I don't want you going around in ignorance. And I'll do my best. If I don't have the answer, I'll try to figure it out. We'll try to figure it out together. But anyway, Sodom and Gomorrah exists. And we know the story, and we're not going to sit here and read through it. Y'all know the story. Everybody that at least attended Sunday school when they were kids probably know roughly the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and how the two angels showed up and the goings on there. They basically showed up in San Francisco. And Lot and his family. Lot was the only righteous man there in the city. And but for the sake of this one righteous man, they held off on destroying Sodom and Gomorrah and told them to go. I told them to go flee to the mountains, you know, flee way over there. Don't look back. And Lot was afraid he wouldn't make it. You know, that he was just afraid they couldn't get that far. So he says to the angels, says, look, you know, look at this village over here. It's small. It's insignificant. Let us go there because we might not make it far enough when you go to destroy these places. So they said, yeah, you could go to the cities. And you know the story about Lot's wife looking back and being turned into a pillar of salt. This is actually a really good segue from what we were just discussing when we were talking about, you know, what's that preacher holding on to? What are they looking back, straddling that line? Now, we know this story. This is a very one of those very well-known Old Testament Bible stories. But why did Lot's wife look back? You know, and why did, you know, she got turned into a pillar of salt and looking back? And I was thinking about this the other day. I was reflecting on this idea. The angels came into this place, and you know, just imagine the wickedness there. You know, where a couple of strangers come into town. And all of the men in the city show up and beat on the door because they want to drag them out and rape them. Or as would be in modern clown world parlance, they want to show them that love is love. And Lot was the only righteous man. So Lot and his family are living in this cesspit of humanity. They're living among these people. In their day-to-day life, you know, I mean, yes, we know the story, but you think about, okay, but what was going on a week before that? Well, Lot and his family were doing business with these people. They had acquaintances. Obviously, they had friends. They knew people there. They were living amongst this. They were living in the world, as it were. They were living amongst the world. They were living amongst this sin and these sinful people. And then, of course, again, we know the rest of the story of the angels showing up and being warned to leave. But why did Lot's wife look back? Because that's what she knew. So often, even when we're in something bad, we have something really bad going on in our lives. And we might be praying for God to deliver us. But to be delivered means going into the unknown. Sometimes we hold on to stuff that's really bad just because we're familiar with it. You know, a lot of times I think when we're having trouble with sin, struggling with sin, trying to overcome sin, we miss the part that is we ourselves that are actually still kind of holding on to it just because we're familiar with it. It might be a really, really bad habit, but at least it's familiar. When you venture off and let that go, when you get out, you're going into the unfamiliar. It's like, okay, well, you're not going to do that anymore. So what's that actually going to be like? Even something bad, you know, is familiar. You see people and they're in toxic relationships and, you know, they'll just stay in that toxic relationship. And for no other reason, but that's what they're familiar with. It's really bad. It's like hell on earth. But they'll stay in it because at least it's familiar. And you say, well, why don't you get out of that relationship? Well, you know, I mean, basically it'll come down, their excuses will come down to that's what they're used to. You know, that's what they're familiar with. Lot had to take his family and flee to the unknown. What's out there? They obviously had a prosperous life living here amongst these sinful people. They were doing very well. They had a business or whatever they were doing. They had a business. They had people they were acquainted with. And they had to let that go and venture off into the unknown. They had to leave everything behind except what they could carry out. They couldn't even go to the bank, draw no money out. They had to just take off with what they have, the clothes on their back and whatever they could pack. And they could go. Lot's wife, no doubt, was thinking about everything they were left leaving behind. And she couldn't let it go. So often, we just can't let things go. And it drags us down. It drags us down because we can't let it go. You see people, and they're grown-ass men. They're grown men. And they're still drugged down by things that happened when they were kids. Or things, mistakes they made 20 years before when they were young adults, and now they're middle age. You got to let it go. You got to let your mistakes go. You got to learn from, but you got to let things go. You know, they would sit out. If someone dies, you know, in like biblical tradition in the Old Testament, I believe that it's like 7 days. You were supposed to put on, you know, your mourning clothes and you mourned for that person 7 days. They had like a set time set and you would be in mourning. Your household would be in mourning for 7 days. And this implies that when the 7 days are up, you're supposed to get up, go wash yourself, take your sackcloth off, put your regular clothes on, quit fasting or whatever it is you're doing, quit your mourning, wipe your face, and go on, because you got to let it go. As much as you may have loved them, as much as you may have cared about them, you've got to let them go now because they're not here. I think a lot of people, when it comes to death and the loss of a loved one, they feel as though if they let them go, it means they didn't love them. You know, it means they didn't love them. Maybe, you know, they tend to reflect on, you know, I wish that one time I said those hurtful words to that person, I hadn't said that. Why, you know, why did I do that? And if I let them go, it means somehow that, like, I didn't love them, or I'm forgetting about them, or I'm not, you know, it takes away the meaning that person had in your life. But it doesn't. Your time to love this person, listen to me now, the time to love somebody in your life is while they're alive. You can have affection for them, and that's not what we're talking about. In other words, when they're gone, you can't love them by your action. And we always talk about how the Bible means action. You love the people in your life by the way you treat them, by the way you interact with them. It is action. You show the love towards this person, your biblical love towards this person, by the way you treat them, by your actions, by your deeds. When they're gone, your opportunity to do that is gone as well. You've got to let them go. It doesn't mean you don't care about them. It doesn't mean you don't miss them. It doesn't mean you don't think about them. I'm not saying you put them out of your mind, never think about them again, but you got to let them go. It doesn't mean you don't love them because you get up and you move on. It doesn't mean that. It means that that stage of your life is over and now you have to go on. I remember when I was young, a young man, a teenager. Back in those days, we all ran around and did what we called made the drag. If you're my age, you know what I'm talking about. Young people don't do that no more. They sit around at home on their computer because everything's illegal. But back in those days, we used to run around. We used to drive around up and down Main Street. And we drank beer. We did. And we didn't kill anybody. We didn't run into each other. We didn't. You know, we just rode around, drank beer, talked with our friends, usually wound up driving around on back roads and whatnot. But we drove up and down Main Street, most of the time drinking beer and, you know, looking for girls. You know, we'd drive up and down with our friends, drink beer and look for girls. Of course, we knew all the girls. This is a small town. We knew all the girls. We'd know that's so-and-so. And that's what we did. And I remember back in those days that once in a while, you would see some guy who was ancient. When you're a teenager, ancient means pushing 40. Now, yeah, it's sad. Sad now because I'm old. But I remember once in a while, you would see some guy who we all thought was ancient because he was like pushing 40, well into his 30s. And this guy is riding around up and down Main Street drinking beer, trying to be like one of y'all. You know, and you might be friendly with the guy because he could buy beer for you and whatnot. And he might be, you know, a good enough dude. But I remember even in my youth thinking how silly this person looked because he's old. But really, I remember thinking how silly this person looked. And it's because that time in that person's life was over now. He had his time where you drove up and down the main street drinking beer, chasing girls. He had that time, but that time was over in his life and he couldn't let it go. And it made him look silly because he's running around like he's a teenager and he's a grown ass man. It made him look silly. Why? Because he couldn't let it go. He had so much fun. He enjoyed doing that so much that he couldn't accept it when it was time to let that part of his life go and move on to the next stage of your life. See, if you can't let those things go, then you can't move on to the next stage of your life. You're supposed to move on. This is what maturing is. One of the things I find striking about life is you begin it with first. You know, you take your first breath. You open your eyes for the first time. You take your first steps. And it's just first. You know, the first day of school. You know, you get your driver's license and you drive a car for the first time. You know, the first time you kiss a girl and the first time you fall in love and the first time you do all these things. But as you age, you become keenly aware that those firsts all get replaced by lasts. The last time you drop your child off at school, you never get to do that again because now they can drive themselves to school. The last time you dropped your child off school, you'll never get to do that again. And it came and went and you didn't even notice it went. And ultimately, of course, this will culminate into the last time you kiss a woman. And ultimately, the last time you open your eyes, the last words you speak, and the last breath you take. Everything rounds out and finishes just like it began. But the firsts are replaced by more and more lasts as you age. And ultimately, you do the last things that you started with. The last time you open your eyes, the last breath you take, the last words you speak. Through this journey, you have to let things go. There comes a time, you know, those things you used to do, you have to accept aging. We live in a society that really makes this difficult because youth is celebrated in this society. This is not the way it was in ancient times and in traditional times. Elders were held up as people. You went from youth, when you were young, you had your youth and you had your vigor. But as you gained wisdom, you know, you ultimately became an elder and people listened to you because you were an elder and you were respected. Assuming you weren't an idiot, you know, if you had wisdom, well, we live in a society that only celebrates youth and doing the things of youth. As such, people have a really hard time just letting it go. I saw a story one time that really stuck with me, and it was something to do with Reba McEntire, country singer, and I don't know, it was some time back, and I don't even remember what it was about. Something happened, anyway, and they were talking, and they said, I don't remember how old she is, she's like 69, 70 years old or something now, And anyway, in the news story, they said they spoke with the, I'm going to say 60, I'm sorry, probably got her age wrong, and I'm too lazy to look it up because it doesn't matter. I'm on a roll. Don't stop me now. Anyway, in the news story, they said, well, they spoke with the 69-year-old or whatever. They spoke with her boyfriend. And that really struck me. It's like, you're an old lady now. What do you mean boyfriend? You're not a teenage girl running around. You, boyfriend? You a nana now. Your nana got a boyfriend. Got to let these things go. There comes a time when those things are gone now. You may have enjoyed them in your youth, but if you're an old person doing the things of a teenager, you look silly. If you're 40 years old driving up and down the drag, drinking beer, chasing high school girls, you know, you look silly. Everybody might be nice to you, but you look silly because you can't let that go. Likewise, you've got to let the things that are painful go. Okay. Circling back to death, you love people while you're with them, which means you do things. It's the way you treat them. It's not even necessarily a feeling of affection, though, yes, that can be part of it as well. But once they're gone, your ability to biblically love them and the way you treat them is now over. So you've got to get up and move on. It doesn't minimize the way you felt for that person when they were with you. It doesn't minimize the fact that, yes, you miss them now. But you do. You've got to get up and you got to let it go. Don't get drugged down by your past, the mistakes you've made or things that were done to you. You've got to let those things go. You got to get up. You got to let them go. Can't be like Lot's wife and stand there and she got to thinking about it and she's like, our home is there. The people we know are there. Imagine if you've been living in a community. I don't know what y'all's situation is. Imagine you've been living in the same community. You know your neighbors and you've got a business or whatever it is, your jobs or whatever. And imagine if you took your family like Lot and you said, we're leaving today. We're throwing everything in the car. We're not telling anybody goodbye. We're going to get up. We're going to get in our car and we're going to leave. We're going to leave everybody we know behind, everything we know behind. We're taking the clothes on our back and we're out of here. Everybody looks at my wife like she an idiot. God told her not to look back and she looked back. But most people would look back because that's what's familiar. She kept thinking about it. That's everybody we know. We got a life there. We got a home there. And you're telling me we got to leave all that and go to who knows what? Who knows what's going to happen to us out here? And she stopped and she looked back and was destroyed for it. You see, God moves you on. You got to move on. It's hard sometimes, yes. But whether the thing behind you is something pleasant that you really want, that you really enjoyed at that time of your life, or whether it's something really bad, something somebody did to you, some injustice done to you, some abuse when you were a child, whatever it is, you got to let that go. You got to get your stuff and you got to keep moving. Whether you're heading to the mountains or the village, wherever God's taking you, you got to go. You got to leave it behind. Quit looking back. I say, if you're a younger person, this probably isn't going to mean as much to you, but I hope you keep this in your heart, because as you age, you change, you go to different phases of your life. And it means that the things you're doing now, when I was young, man, as a kid, and I was always looking forward to the next thing. You know, I was always looking forward to the next thing. Once I can do that, then, you know, everything will be right. You know, once I get my driver's license, once I can drive, I'll independence, I'll be able to do this. Once I'm out of school, I can do this. That's going to be the, you know, and on and on. And while it's fine to look forward to things and have goals, the problem with getting so fixated on that is you miss the here and now. There are certain things that you can do in your life right now, right here, right now, that you can only do right here, right now. And if you're constantly thinking about someday I'm going to, then you're going to miss the things that you can only do now. And then when someday gets here and now you can do that thing you were so looking forward to and it winds up, it really wasn't all that you imagined. You have a tendency to look back and go, why didn't I enjoy then? Why didn't I enjoy what I was doing at that time? Why, instead of always just looking up like, oh, I want to do this other thing. There are certain things you can only do right now, right here, right now. But when the, you know, and you need to enjoy those things so that when the time, you know, to do those things, because when the time comes that now you have to move on to the next thing, you've got to let that go and move on to the next thing. Another casual observation I made the other day. Have you ever noticed, and this seems to really be particular, I think, towards women, but as a general rule, have you ever noticed these people that we got around us here in Clown World who are like obsessed with rule following? You know, if there's a rule, we saw it, we talked last, I believe it was last week, we talked last week, you know, we were revisiting the COVID thing and talking about the masks and stuff like that. And you would have these people, you know, you got to follow the rules. You can't stand any closer. And how ridiculous. You know, we were just going back and remembering how ridiculous all of it was to keep it in mind. You know, just to keep that in mind, what was imposed. And one of the points we talked about last week was how, you know, it, most of it wasn't enforced by the government. It was enforced by regular other people. Have those people like, you know, you've got to stand 6 foot apart. Why are you standing within 6 foot? They're practically going around the tape measure. You're within the 6 foot. You're 5'9". You're going to kill me. And I was thinking about that. And have you ever noticed that the people that are the more obsessed, the people who are most obsessed with rule enforcement, you got to follow the rules. The people who really get upset if they're driving the speed limit down the highway and someone blows around them going fast and they get mad and they're like, how dare they? The people most obsessed with following the rules, you got to follow the rules. That's the rules. We got to have rules. And again, you can see this really reflected primarily, I think, a lot in women. But we have so many very effeminate men in our society now that you will see this in reflected in them as well. Because a lot of what these effeminate men do is feminine in nature. They act like women, which is very off-putting. It's one thing for women to act like women, but when you see some guy and he acts, you know, in his nature feminine by the way he reacts to things, it's very off-putting. But anyway, one of the things I notice is the people who are most adamant about rule following, and you need to follow the rules, and these are the rules, we got to follow the rules, tend to be the people who are also the most, what do I want to say, the most rebellious against God's rules. You ever notice that? The ones that will sit there and demand and tell you you're a bad person and you got to do what the government tells you to and you've got to do what you're told and you got to follow the rules. If you look at that person and the way they live their lives, most often, they're some of the most rebellious, lawbreaker, rule-breaking people when it comes to God's rules, to God's laws. Now, at first glance, this might not make a lot of sense. They're a rule follower. They demand everybody follow the rules. How come they're in rebellion against God's rules, against God's laws? But when you think about it, it actually makes sense because they have replaced God. For that person, the government, quote-unquote, authority. You see, people long for an authority in their life. Well, we have an authority. We have our God, our Father. We have the Lord God Almighty, the creator of all things, is the ultimate authority. His authority overrides the authority of man, overrides the temporary authority of governments and those who wield power. God's authority is above all of these things. We have a longing for that. But you see, these people have rejected God. They've rejected Jesus Christ, his son. And they have replaced the Lord with men, with rules, with men's rules, with government. Their God is government. Their God is man's authority. They have no faith in God. They've replaced that with the government, with man's laws, with man's rules. And they are the most evangelical about enforcing these rules. You see some woman and she's screeching at a complete stranger that they're violating some government mandated rule. you know, some government mandate, she's screeching at the top of her lungs and making a fool out of herself in public. You can be almost guaranteed that if she's married, she's in rebellion against her husband. She's in rebellion against God. You just guaranteed, if you could look in that person's life, every aspect of their life is on some level or another in rebellion against God's rules, God's laws, the natural order of things. Remember, when I talk about God's rules and laws, I'm not saying you got to go back here and look through the Old Testament and find every rule. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you just summarize it as the natural order of things, things laid out to us in the Bible, things that God has established, the natural order, the natural rule of things, the natural way things are supposed to flow. You have some screeching woman rule enforcer. She shows up in your physical congregation church. And you tell her, no, you can't be on the board of such and such. We don't allow women positions of authority in the church. This is a traditional church. She's going to go off the rails. How dare you? Because she's in rebellion against God's laws. What she is following is the rules and the laws of man. There's been no shortage of ink spilled or words spoken about the destructive nature of feminism on women themselves and society as a whole. It doesn't benefit anybody. Women are more miserable now than they've ever been, and yet they cling to it. This is a fundamental building block of this satanic society, this satanic natured world that we find ourselves in now. Because women were convinced to be, feminism was nothing more than convincing women to be in rebellion against God's laws. And it's established as a way of life. And virtually every woman you're going to find in this world today on some level is a feminist. I mean, she is. She might tell you she's the most trad woman in her, and you think you found you a trad woman and you're going to marry her and you're talking about your vows and you get to that submit to your husband part and she's going to balk at that. She's going to be like, well, wait a minute. What do you mean submit now? We're supposed to be a co-equal democracy marriage. We're a co-equal democracy marriage. But what if we got a tie? You know, somebody's got to be able to make a decision, and if I want to do this and you want to do that, we're at an impasse. Well, that's what the government's for. I'd see you in divorce court because the government's going to break that tie, and I can tell you which way it's going to go. Feminism was establishing in society, in the rule of law, women rebelling against God's laws, God's rules, the natural order of things. Again, so often you'll see the most adamant, the more adamant somebody is about, you got to follow the rules, got to follow the laws, the more you're going to find that person is a lawbreaker about the things of God. Anyway, it's just an observation, but you can take note. I can guarantee you the more adamant somebody is about, you got to follow the rules, you got to follow the laws, the more you're going to find that person in rebellion against God's laws. It's kind of one of those weird things. It's where they put their heart, where their heart lies. You know, the Bible tells us, you know, where your heart lies, where your treasure is, there your heart lies. And, you know, we're told that in the New Testament, it says over and over, the wisdom of God is foolishness to the world and vice versa. The wisdom, worldly wisdom, is foolishness to God. And this is demonstrated on the people God uses. He uses time and time again, the Bible uses these regular people, not, you know, some highly respected priest or something. He goes and finds some Joe Schmo out there fishing or something and uses him. This is just demonstrates how God doesn't operate in the ways of man. And I was thinking about the foolishness before we wrap up. As we continue with our rambling Christian specific segment, I was thinking about, you know, the foolishness of man, wisdom of the world, and vice versa and whatnot. And I was thinking, one of the easiest ways to think about this is imagine there's a line and we're all on this path. You're all traveling down this road. You got, say, two people, make it simple, and they're on these paths and they're all walking. They're on this journey, traveling down this long road. And at the end of that road, there is a line, and it's guaranteed the line is there. And of course, obviously, that line is death. Now, we always depend, depending on what your life is like, you may convince yourself that that line is always going to be way off somewhere. Or you may want to be convincing, if you're really depressed, you may be trying to convince yourself the line is really close. But regardless of that, you're guaranteed that the line is there. Because everybody's going to die. You might want to think about that. You might want to think that's never going to, they need to be way off in some obscure future. But it is coming. You're guaranteed that as these two men travel along, you're going to cross that line. Now, you work as you travel on your journey and you collect things. Now, wisdom of the world and the things of this world, you collect things that you can have now. You carry, because you collect these things that you can put in your hands. Usually money and things, and you collect money and things, and you got this money and you got your things and you got them. But you get this guy over here and he doesn't have very much. And the people of the world look at this guy over here doesn't have very much and be like, you know, well, he's a failure in life. I always say it's funny how, you know, people say, well, what's that guy worth? And what that everybody knows that what that means is how much money's in his bank account. What's he worth? As if this is the measure of the value of a man. You look at this guy and he don't have very much. And you look at him and it's like, the guy over here has got a whole bunch. He's collected houses and money and gold and silver, whatever. Lots of cars. And you got this guy over here and he don't have very much. And everybody says Snickers because this guy doesn't have very much. And he's like, you know, people be like, well, where are the things? What are you doing with your life? You aren't collecting very many things. But you see, this man, he is collecting things and putting them on the other side of that line. It's like an investment for the future. He's collecting things, but the things he's collecting are of a different nature than what the other man is collecting. What he is collecting is automatically deposited on the other side of that line. You can't see them because they're on the other side of the line. They're way up ahead. He's got a guaranteed payout, but it isn't right now. It's just like an investment account. And everything he's making, you know, it's like when you hear stories about, you know, this guy that lives in a shack, you know, and everybody's like, man, he was so poor. And then that person dies and they find out that the guy had millions of dollars, you know, in his bank account, you know, and nobody knew he was actually rich because he lived like a beggar. Everything this guy is getting automatically is deposited in an account over that line. And you go through life, and inevitably the day comes when both men cross over that line. Now, just as it's guaranteed the line exists, another guarantee is that when you pass through the line, when you cross over the line, which is death, you're not allowed to take anything with you. When you cross over, when you step over that line, you got to the end of your journey, and now it's that time, and you step over that line. Everything that you were carrying with you, whether it is much or little, is stripped off of you. Another guarantee is no matter what you have in this life, no matter how much you have or how little you have, whatever you have got will be taken away from you. If you're in life and you've got a bank account full of money and lots of cars and life is good for you, that is going to be taken away from you with 100% certainty. Because when you step over that line, that will be stripped away and you cannot touch it anymore. You cannot have it anymore. It will be taken away from you. That is a guaranteed deal. Now, when the two men step over that line and both of them, everything is stripped away and taken away from them that they had, that they could carry in their hand. For the man who had little in this life, he's not losing a lot. Now, the guy over here that had a whole bunch, he's losing everything because this is what he put his life into. This is what he put his heart into the entire time he was here in this world. He's lost everything. The other man, he hasn't lost much. He didn't have much to begin with. But now as they step over that line and see what is in this new world, this new life, the man who had plenty, the man who had wealth, he discovers that now he has nothing and there's nothing for him. It's a barren. He is in abject poverty now that he has stepped over the line. And he looks over here at this guy that everybody mocked and ridiculed and talked about how he wasn't worth much. And this man has a great amount of treasure. He has a great amount of wealth. You see, because everything he put his heart into in life was invested so that when he stepped over the line, he's ready. Where your heart will be, you know, where your treasure is, your heart will be also. As we go through this journey in life, whether you have a lot or whether you have a little, what matters is how much you're investing in the life to come, how much you're investing in what's over that line. We've got to wrap up. I rambled longer than I thought I would. I hope you enjoyed all of this week's show. I hope you enjoyed, of course, especially our Christian-specific discussion. It is the highlight. Honestly, it is. It's the part I enjoyed the most of the show. I hope you enjoyed all of it, though. And I hope you'll come back and join us next week for the Parish of the Patriots.